Well, as I said, it's a great pleasure being here, and we made use of the opportunity this morning to go to the Pitt Rivers Museum, which was for me the first time, I have to admit. And of course, you understand that I've been looking at creepy crawlies and doing all sorts of other things, taking photos, so I was already thinking about my next talk and using those photos. But they're not in here today. So what I wanted to do today is to talk mainly about Gesner, but also a little bit about Carolus Clusius, and especially about the role that correspondence networks played in the obtaining of images. So the visual part of natural history is going to be central. Seeing if this works. Yes, okay. Occasionally I'm going to turn around to check if I'm talking about the right picture. The two protagonists of the story today are Gesner and Clusius, and as you know, they were among the most famous naturalists of the 16th century. Naturalists, scientists, but also humanists, both of them with an excellent training and background in a rather broad range of topics. And what I wanted to do first is really to show you, rather than talk, about, so visually show you the connection between correspondence, science, humanism, and images, that is, representations of naturalia. The first five images I'm going to show you concern one correspondent of Clusius, an Englishman, I chose him on purpose, of course, called John Caius, or Keyes, originally from Norwich. You all know about him because he was one of the founders of Keyes College. The first image you see concerns a lynx, one of my favorite animals, but also the favorite animal of the Academia dei Lincei, of course, in a slightly later period. And you see the printed version in Gesner's work. Here is the image that was the basis for that printed version. And as you can see, I hope, is that there's a caption with it, which I don't know how readable it is for you, this bit here. Gives you the information that this image was sent by Caius to Gesner. So that is one of the informations in which the image plus the caption itself tells us that an image has reached Gesner, in this case, by means of correspondence from another country and from England, in this case. Then there will be two images with similar captions, both of them again sent by John Caius to Gesner. In this case, this image and the following one, we can always come back to these images if you want, by the way, later after my talk, if you want to see more details and so on. But these two images were not printed in Gesner's work. So we know from the caption that they were sent by Caius to Gesner, but he didn't use them, he didn't like them, or he liked them, but they didn't fit him with his project. We don't know why he didn't use them. That's one of the things to be found out. Here is yet another one, a kind of elk, I would call it, but I'm not totally sure. I'm not the zoologist, I should admit. And here we have the same image with the printed version. And you also see that the antlers have been included in the picture. So you see here the grouping of images still sent by Caius to Gesner. And you see how they have been put together and joined in the printed image. By the way, all the references to the image numbers in the manuscripts are in there, but I can always give you further information if you like. And I usually indicate in the slide the first time that these particular images were printed in one of the works of Gesner. I've gone through all of them, but of course I may have made mistakes, so please correct me if you find any. Now, Caius was by no means the only contact of Gesner in Great Britain. Another famous one was William Turner, who lived between 1503 and 1568, and who published one of the first works on British ornithology, as you probably know, in 1544. He was a friend of Gesner, a Calvinist, who spent quite a number of years in exile from England and mainly in Germany. He visited Gesner in Switzerland and sent Gesner quite a lot of information about birds, including some really hilarious stories about a pelican living at court in northern France, southern Belgium, as it is now, which Gesner included in his printed editions. He didn't include an image of that pelican, not of that particular pelican, I'm sorry to say. Now, I will give you a few further examples of correspondence of Gesner in other European countries, continental countries, who sent images to Gesner every time we know almost for certain that these images were included in correspondence sent as part of a package or whatever the way exactly was, but that these images were not handed in person by the friend, let's say, to Gesner, but that they were sent in some way. So they are part of, let's say, the attachments of correspondence. Here we see a very, very nice image of a coati. I'm not sure you pronounce it that way, but it's an American animal. And to my knowledge, this is the first drawing of a coati in European history. It got printed later, and here you should see that print emerge. This time it's not reversed, and that's a topic I will come back to in a minute. But this image, the drawing, was sent to Gesner by an Italian called Antonio Musa Brassavola, or Brassavola, I'm not sure where the emphasis is, from Ferrara. And he was not just somebody, he was a friend and physician of the Grand Duke Ercole II d'Este in Ferrara. But he also worked as a top physician for François the Premier of France, for Henry VIII of England, for the Habsburg Emperor Charles V, and for three or four popes. So he was really at the top of his profession. And this particular animal is indicated in the caption as a mus indicus, so it's an Indian mouse, basically. And the very intriguing, see if I can go back, I think so, yes. In the caption here, you can see that there's some remark about a comparison with Belong. It looks like the Ichneumon of Belong. And there's a very abbreviated bit of Latin in which it is said that in the year 1603, in the month of November, I saw a similar one, but it was less red in color, and it's also being called an Ichneumon. So I'll come back to that remark of the I saw in Basel. Here I go on to the next. Yes, here we get to the fish, and yet another correspondent of Gesner and friend. He is called in the German version or Latinized version Julius Alexandrinus von Neustein or Giulio Alessandrini, born in Trent, and he lived between 1506 and 1590, so again a contemporary. And yet again we find him to be a physician at the top level, personal physician of the Habsburg Princess Ferdinand I and the Emperor Maximilian II and also the Emperor Rudolf II. So we're in Habsburg court circles here. Then we find here another slide of a fish, yet again with the printed correspondences, a sargus, a fish. And yet again, it's a composite image in the sense that you find two images here on one page, which have been in this printed edition, in fact, split up over two different pages. But you can see that the teeth and jaws of that particular fish have been ended up on a different page, as should be the case, of course, to fit in with the text in the printed edition. Now, this particular fish was sent by to Gesner by a Dutchman called Gijsbertus Horstius, or Gijsbert van der Horst, via another northerner called Cornelius Sittardus. And Gijsbert van der Horst, or Horstius, lived between about 1500 and 1551 and spent most of his time actually as an expert surgeon and physician in Rome, where he was working as a surgeon at the Hospital of Santa Maria della Consolazione in Rome, and where he got visited by a lot of northerners, and especially physicians, Germans, Dutch, and others, who were on, let's say, an academic grand tour in Italy or studied in Padua, went on to Rome and visited this Horstius. Now, Horstius was a specialist in surgery, and in fact, this hospital was a very early hospital specializing in traumatic treatment, so fractures and the effects of knife fights and accidents, incidents at work, people falling off roofs and so on, that kind of specialization. And Horstius, so he was an expert in that kind of medicine, but he was also an expert in poisons. He held snakes in the garden, wrote a book on poisons, and he had his own naturalia collection in mid-16th century Rome, where he knew, insofar as we know, about everybody of any relevance in this kind of medical naturalist field. So about Sittardus, we know, in fact, even less, and I'm trying to get my hands on this Horstius, especially living in Rome, I want to know more about him, but I don't know yet very much. Sittardus we know even less about, except that he was a German physician from Nuremberg who visited Horstius in Rome, stayed with him for a while, studied probably in Italy, traveled back to Germany, and acted as a kind of, let's say, agent, maybe broker of information between Rome and Horstius on the one side and Gessner on the Swiss side, because Gessner, of course, was based in Zurich. So that is more or less all we know about, or I know about Sittardus, so anybody who knows more, please tell me. Horstius probably provided contact in Rome for these visitors, including Sittardus, with collectors and of naturalia, or collectors in general, and painters. And Sittardus, as I said, acted as an intermediary. He may also have commissioned drawings himself in Rome. So this gives me the impression, if especially if I add that we find in the albums that I'm tell you more about in a minute, we find a large group of drawings, all with captions saying this drawing was given to Gessner by Horstius or via Sittardus, a large group. It gives me the impression that Gessner was maybe commissioning image at a distance via correspondence, or at least had been talking to other Germans, other Swiss, or passing visitors in Switzerland, saying to them, if you go to Rome, if you go to Italy, anywhere in Italy, look out for interesting drawings of maybe even a list of animals, or just a more general commissioning in the sense that he said, can you get me anything interesting from there? We don't know about that, but this is a guess on my part. This is another example of drawings which reached Gessner via the same Horstius and or Sittardus. And in fact, there are images in which we know that they were printed, other images like the previous one that I showed you that we found in these albums and that were not printed in Gessner. And again, we have to answer the question at some point why they were not used. Whether they were not good enough, not accurate enough, which would be an interesting kind of thing to find out, because it would tell us about the criteria of Gessner in selection. It could also be that there are simply practical reasons why they were not included, because they had too many or whatever. Anyhow, at this moment, it's guesswork. Then, no, I'm going back, sorry. Again, okay. Here I've included a last correspondent just for these examples, let's say, of Gessner. It's the image is a small crab, as you can see, and this one was used in print, as you can also see. It was sent by a rather unknown, at least to me, Dr. Sebastianus Boetius. Boots, I'm not sure of the pronunciation or the exact spelling, but the caption tells us that it has something to do with Montpellier and with Gessner. So I'm looking particularly at Jill, saying, well, would you perhaps know this person? Because I don't know who it is. And we know that from the list of persons being thanked by Gessner in the introduction to his bird volume, Historia Animalium, Part 3, He names a long list of people being thanked there for their contributions to his images or for information. And this Dr. Sebastianus Boots, or Boots, is described there as medicus ornatissimus and as a physician in Strasbourg. Maybe at that moment, maybe he was at some point in Montpellier, I really don't know, but I'd love to know more about him. So to sum up this brief section about the images that reached Gessner in this particular way via correspondence and correspondence from all over Europe, we see that many of these people, these men, I should say, were physicians, more or less at the top of their profession, working in specialized hospitals or for clients at a very top level of society, such as the Habsburg Emperor, the Popes, Princes, Grand Dukes, and so on. Many of them, or even most, were not merely physicians, moreover, but naturalists in their own right. Often they were collectors of naturalia as well. And we know that such persons could be found corresponding with Gessner in England, in Italy, in Germany, the Alsace, in Austria, in probably many other countries as well. We know that some of these physicians, maybe Sittardus, acted as a kind of agents who helped to get Gessner images from places where he couldn't go to himself. And we know that there are far more correspondents, I will come back to this a bit later, in different parts of Europe, who also sent images, but we can't always trace that kind of evidence. But for the moment, there is a kind of geographical emphasis in the network of Gessner's correspondents sending him images on Switzerland, Germany, Italy, France, and England, and maybe one or two persons in Poland. Now, it is clear from this and from all the further evidence that you can gather about this that this correspondence network played a very crucial role in Gessner's obtaining visual material for his big Historia Animalium in the four volumes plus additional volumes. Obviously, this is nothing new. I mean, I'm not saying anything that most of you probably don't know, except that the material is now, let's say, more extensive. Scholars in the historians in the 20th century have been writing about Gessner's sources, and most recently Sachiko Kusukawa has written an excellent essay about the sources of Gessner's printed images. But now we have those original images, and that's what I want to tell you a bit more about before returning to the correspondence networks. As some or maybe many of you know by now, is that I've fairly recently found two albums in the Amsterdam University Library which contain these images, the images I've been showing you, and that it took me a long time to realize that they were actually connected to Gessler, but not just as copies, but as the originals for the printed images in the Historia Animalium. So I want to tell you a little bit about what kind of groups these images form and about the identification of the whole stuff to make it more clear why I'm or in what direction I want to do further research on them, because obviously it has only started now by identifying them, and then you can start with a whole new range of questions. So these albums which you see here, that was obviously a photo take with all the stuff in around it in the Amsterdam University Library, and all of the photos are just my own photos. This is nothing professional about them. The images, as I told you already and showed you briefly, have annotation with them, and in the annotation you see that there is a reference to a, not a reference, that there is an I person talking about himself. I saw this particular animal, the coati, in 1603 in Basel. So we have to wonder about who that person is, or I had to wonder about it when I was talking about identification. And I'm sorry, going the wrong way. Here you see the other side of the story. When some of the annotation says, I saw something, much of the other annotation says, this was given to Gessner, which makes it very clear. Do you see that in the case of the Panther? And you see that up there, which is the blown up annotation for the little crab, that Gessner is mentioned here as a person and not as an I person. So he's this, you know, the person to whom things are getting sent, and this is obviously written not by the man himself, otherwise he wouldn't have talked about himself like that. So there's annotation in the first person, and we see that annotation in a very curious way coming, an intriguing way coming up, when you see in this case that there are images of shells, and when the author, you can see, I can point with that, but it doesn't matter, you can see in some of the annotation, de meo pictus, and even by HB, and there's another one, ex meo. So this is a reference to somebody who obviously owns shells in his collection and has them painted. Now, we know from the literature that the Gessner collection, after his death, his early death, in 1565, was probably split up, and that parts of it ended in the hands of, eventually via other people, in the hands of Camerarius, and this concerns particularly the plant material, the herbals and the drawings and so on, and the herbaria. What we didn't really know what was happening and what had happened to the material of the animals. So there were a few objects, naturalia, some of those still remain in Switzerland, many have simply disappeared. And we also know that some material ended up with Felix Platter, the physician from Basel, and naturalist, collector, anatomist, and so on. Famous person in his own right, I think, and certainly belonging to a very famous, maybe even notorious, Platter family of Basel. What we don't exactly know, and I still haven't managed to find out, is actually how Platter got this material, whether he bought it from a legacy, because this probably happened quite a long time after Gessner's death, because Platter was still relatively young at the time that Gessner died in 1565. He may have bought it, being young, he may have been given it by legacy, he may have received it via friends of Gessner who had it first. I honestly don't know, but we do know that eventually material ended up with Platter. Some of that material remains in Basel at this moment, and there are two albums with images and written annotation, one containing images of minerals and stones and fossils, another animal, yet again in the university library, in the university library in Basel, with images of birds and annotation. And the tricky thing is that bird album consists of fragments, I should say. It's very incomplete, and moreover, it consists of images and annotation which have been cut out and pasted in on 18th century paper. So these are original captions, let's say, and somebody has been cutting out and pasting in both the captions and the images on 18th century paper, whereas the mineral and fossils and so on album in Basel is original, is 16th century, and has captions and images which are cut out, but the captions have been written on the paper itself. So it's a very sort of tricky detail, because it has a lot to do with the dating of these things. Now, that mineral album in Basel is therefore, we know it was in the possession of Platter, we know that it contains material that was used and in the possession of Gessner, and obviously it formed a very crucial element for comparison when I was beginning to think that the albums in Amsterdam might actually have come from the same persons, that is Gessner and afterwards Platter. Now, as I've said, the annotation in the I person must be connected with this person. You see Platter here with a small detail of some items from his collection. And putting all the information together, the information about the history of Gessner's legacy, ending the fact that some parts of it ended up with Platter, the fact that Platter was a collector himself, the fact that the annotation in these particular Amsterdam albums contains dating long after the death of Gessner, but stopping just before the death of Platter. The last year in it is mentioned is 1610. That the languages are in German and Latin of the annotation, no other languages, that there are words in Basel dialect in it, and that the place names mentioned in it are often located in Switzerland. So there's I saw in Basel, the Coati, and so on. There are some other place names in Strasbourg, Basel, and that area. Plus, well, a few other things, but these are the main items really. Made me think that these images were, that these albums were in fact Platter albums containing again material coming from the Gessner legacy. Now, why I think that these particular images, insofar as used by Gessner, were not, I should say it in a different way, that these images, insofar as corresponding to the printed images in Gessner, were the originals and not copies after, is because most of these images are reversed. And I think you've seen in a number of the pictures I've shown you that nearly all of them, and I'm talking about like about 90% of all of the images that can be found in the albums that were also printed are reversals. So that basically gave me the idea that there can't be many other explanations than, you know, that these must be indeed the originals. So to sum up, what we find in these albums is actually material from two collections. It's a collection within a collection. It's Gessner material depicting beasts, four-footed beasts, some serpents, quite a lot of insects, and then in the second album, anything to do with the sea. So fish, mollusks, crustaceans, shells, water insects, or whatever one would call them now, I'm not sure. But anything to do with water. And rivers and sea, I should say. So that is what we found in what we find in these two particular albums. What we see is images that once belonged to Gessner, and images that were collected by Platter himself, all put in these albums. All of them cut out along the contours of the beast or animal, whatever it is. There are very few images which have a background, but even those are still cut out and then pasted in on the 16th century paper. I should add the watermarks are all from the 16th century, that helps. And so we find a collection in which, on the one hand, we can find images that were sent to Gessner or collected by himself, we can't always tell, and then pasted in by Platter in albums that were composed by him. And on the other hand, images that were collected by Platter himself, obviously somewhere between the 1560s and his death in 1615, and then mixed with the Gessner material and then grouped and organized in the ways that he liked. So it is a Platter collection, and yet it's also a Gessner collection. It makes it complicated with the dating and with the attribution, obviously. And one of my main problems in identification is that the only way I can be certain that something was not a Platter edition but an original Gessner is by checking it against the printed images. But as we can also see already from the few examples I've given, there are images in there which were not used. I can't find them in the printed Gessner editions. And yet the annotation by Platter says these images were given to Gessner. So there are mysteries here, unsolved for the moment. This may be material collected by Gessner and then discarded, as I said, simply not used for some reason. It may be that Platter was wrong and that he says something while not knowing it. Or it might be, and that's my impression at the moment, that there could be cases in which we find images here which Gessner does mention actually in his printed text, because he often does that, but does not print. So he talks about it in language, but he doesn't show it. And so for some reason, he didn't have room enough in the book or so. So they weren't used. We have them now, and we can start, you know, again filtering through all of the editions of all of the volumes to see if this is the case. This is something I haven't done as yet, and it takes probably another few months at least. So to conclude this little section, I wanted to show you, well, that one's one you've already seen, the eye captions with Platte's own image. And I wanted to show you here one image which was certainly not collected by Gesner, and therefore must be a Platte edition, also because of the dating. Because here we see a not terribly beautiful insect. I call it an insect, but it probably has a more specific name. It's there in the middle of that page. Platte you have up there. And you see that from the caption, we can tell that it was given to Gesner by Onorio Belli. And Onorio Belli is a person who, one of my favorites, from Vicenza, a friend of the Palladio family, a physician, again, son of an apothecary. And he went to work on Crete. He became the private physician of the governor of Crete, who was operating there on behalf of the Venetians, because Crete belonged to Venice in that period. So he went off to Crete, and one of the most fascinating things about him is that he was a combined archaeologist and naturalist, and that he was the first person to make an archaeological survey of Crete and make drawings of Knossos. I don't know why the man is not more famous than that, except he was very unlucky and all his material got lost. So we only know he did this because of correspondence, again, correspondence. And the other thing is that he was also an excellent field botanist, and he made one of the first surveys of the Cretan flora in the late 16th century, 1580s, I think he was there, 1580s and 90s. And that he, again, most of this was lost. He wanted to publish a book after his return to Italy. He never did because most of the material was gone. There was a shipwreck, correspondence got lost, and so on. But we know that he did this partly because he sent a lot of his material to Clusius, who was by then already based in Leiden. Clusius included very, very long appendices to his Historia Plantarum, Historia, I forgot the title at the moment, doesn't matter, of 1601. And in these appendices, he basically prints what he gets. So he doesn't really adapt, doesn't make any editing, he doesn't make any adaptations to the text he got. He found Belli's letters so interesting that he printed the whole lot in about 15 or 16 pages, Latin descriptions per plant of plants that Belli found in Crete. So here we find Onorio Belli suddenly popping up, to my great pleasure, in these albums as a correspondent of Felix Platte. And investigating a little bit more about Onorio Belli, it turned out that he was in fact corresponding not only with Clusius, but with a lot of other naturalists in Italy, in Switzerland, and in Germany, such as the Bauhins, Camerarius, and, as I said, Clusius. So in this case, we find a little trait d'union in the person of Onorio Belli via the Amsterdam albums, the Swiss Amsterdam albums, I should say, between the correspondence networks of Platte and Clusius, and with a sort of link back into the Gesner period. So I would like to jump briefly to Clusius and his network, and then return to Gesner and the images. If we look at the correspondence network of Clusius, thinking back to the correspondence of Gesner that we were just talking about, after all, they were more or less contemporaries, although Clusius lived for a much longer period. He died in 1609, and Gesner in 1565, so there was also a large non-overlap between their lifetimes. Okay, if we look at Clusius' network, we see that he has correspondence. We have identified in the Clusius project about 340 in all over Europe, really ranging from Greece and southern Italy, Spain, Portugal, throughout mainland continental Europe, to England, Scotland, and even Norway. So really the whole of Europe. I've tried putting this briefly the places on the map where Clusius himself lived for longer than a few months. And he traveled, of course, far far more. But these were just the places where he was based for a longer period. And here we see the countries with which Clusius maintained correspondence, in the sense that in these countries people were living with whom he had a fairly long-standing correspondence. Now, one of the main points that I have wanted to make in my book about the correspondence networks of Clusius was that such correspondence between naturalists did not only maintain relations but actually helped to create them. So we are often talking about correspondence between people who never actually met in person but got to know each other via other correspondence, via friends of friends who recommended each other and then started writing to each other. So this is literally a virtual network, in the sense of, you know, virtual not being face-to-face contact. So it didn't only maintain relations but helped to create them. And that crisscrossing networks of correspondence, because they often overlap in this particular period, that they helped actually create, in terms of the contents of those correspondence, but also in terms of the social relationships, that they helped to create and establish the norms and the rules of interaction and the standards of evidence in a community of scientists, scholars, whatever we call them, naturalists, and thereby helped to create natural history as a discipline, as an academic discipline, or scholarly and scientific discipline. So in short, I think that the exchanges of material objects, including drawings, and of knowledge in those networks helped to create the discipline itself. And so that was one of, basically, of the arguments, the points that I wanted to make in that book, including very much the fact that a lot of the members of these networks were not academics. They were apothecaries, they were noble women, they were people from court society, physicians, courtiers, composers, amateurs, priests, and you name it. I mean, people who were interested in nature and who gained a lot of experience in this field by either studying it in practice, growing plants and describing them, having them painted, commissioning people to do things for them, lay out botanical gardens. So, I mean, it's a really vast range and a very diverse set of people that we're talking about. And I'm talking about expertise, let's say, being exchanged by these very diverse people in via correspondence and helping to constitute those, let's say, principles, criteria, standards of knowledge, including the social customs, you know, that belong with this setting of the new scholarly scientific community. There are other issues, let's say, that could be important, but I'm not going into those now, such as the whole thing of place and the importance of the setting itself in which these things happened. But that would take us into maybe a bit too far away. I want to conclude this little bit about Gesner, about Clusius and his network, by showing you one more picture of two images which were actually sent, in this case, to Clusius, which were the basis for his illustrations. And it's very typical that we have only two, whereas Clusius' network, we know far more about it than about Gesner's network. It's included probably a larger number of people, and we have by far, far more letters belonging to the people, belonging in fact to Clusius, because they were sent to him, but having been written by other people, by these correspondents, is about 1,300 letters or so. And it's very typical that we have only two images, whereas now for Gesner we have this much vaster number of images of which formed the originals for his printed illustrations. Now these two are the potato, obviously, then an exotic plant from America, and the pepper sent to Clusius by James, one of my favorite persons, James Garrett, the apothecary from London. These images are both in the Plantijn Museum in Antwerp, not in Leiden, therefore they don't form part of the correspondence collection of Clusius in Leiden, probably because these images were separated from the letters may be given by Clusius to his printers, printer publishers, and for some reason not destroyed after printing. So it gives you also a bit of an idea how rare it is that we do have the originals for printed images. Now, going back to Gessner, we know, of course, there is quite a bit known about his network of correspondence, but insofar as I've been able to trace, we know of about 250 different correspondents, many of them medical men, as in the case of Clusius. There are some 500 letters still extant. His correspondents were mainly physicians, scholars, and certainly very highly educated people, maybe more than in Clusius' case, which might have something to do with the fact that Clusius was actually never at a university in his life until he was in his late 60s and until he died in his 80s at Leiden. That was the only time in his life when he was ever working for a university. All the rest of the time he was at court, different courts, or he was a kind of independent consultant for princes, so still connected to court, but not at universities. So Gessner's correspondence, many physicians, again at the top level, scholars and otherwise highly educated people. And another parallel between the two is that Gessner's network, like that of Clusius, formed a mode of exchange. It wasn't just, as has been sometimes mentioned about Darwin, that things went to Darwin. Information, objects, descriptions, experiments, and so on. And that Darwin used them and that was that. And he said, thanks to the correspondent, that was it. Maybe I'm exaggerating a bit, but okay. In the cases of Gessner and Clusius, both cases, we see that both thank their correspondents by name and often quote them in their printed works, their published works. So a lot of the credits, basically, are being given publicly. And that is a way of really publicly thanking these correspondents. Gessner did that in the form of lists, as I mentioned it briefly before, a long list of people, I thank you and these people for sending me images and so on. There are more of these lists. Clusius didn't have lists, but he had all the names of his correspondents in the text. And Gessner does it in even more detail, I should almost say, because in many of the descriptions of the animals in his Historia Animalium, you find sections in which he says, thanks to Dr. So-and-so for sending me the image, and tells a little story about a particular animal, repeats a bit of a letter like William Turner about the pelican flying at court and so on in the Burgundian setting or late Burgundian setting. So you see that Gessner really incorporates, like Clusius with Onorio Belli, text and images sent to him by many of the correspondents. The fact that Gessner and Clusius both do this is obviously one of the major ways that they have helped us as historians to find out what their sources are. That was, I don't think, their intention, but because I think the intention was basically to say thanks to people and publicly. But it, for us, it is a major, major source of information to be able to trace these networks, but also to find out a lot more about the community of naturalists in Europe, about people who themselves often did not publish. So although Sachiko Kusukawa has explored in her article about the sources of Gessner's images, a lot of the people who were giving him images, I think by perhaps uniting the information, the further information that is already given in the printed texts of both Clusius and Gessner, and maybe other naturalists that I know less about, plus linking that to the information we can now find in the annotation to these Amsterdam albums, we can actually piece together a larger a more detailed picture of the community of naturalists in late 16th century Europe. Now I want to go back for the last little part of my talk to Gessner and his network exchanges and what I call by sort of, I'm not very pleased about this myself, but I've called it for the moment the formation of a visual canon. And I hate the word canon, really, but I don't really know how to put it briefly in another way. But thinking about what I said before about how correspondence networks, in Clusius's case, can help to create and set standards of scholarly interaction, of evidence, of scholarly criticism, scientific criticism, whatever you want to call it, I was beginning to think that it might be interesting to look at images, because I've been looking at, in the case of Clusius, mainly at his textual information, also because we have far less information about Clusius' images. But now we have these albums, and I thought it would be really interesting to know, to look in a slightly different way at the images themselves, because they were part of that interaction in exchange by network, by correspondence network, to see how they might have contributed to the formation of a kind of scholarly set of standards of representing naturalia. And that's why I used the word canon, but as I said, I'm not really happy about that word. So I wanted to show you a few examples of the direction in which I'm thinking. And this is honestly, it's something that I'm working on. I haven't really made up my mind about it. And it's something I hope to be able to integrate in about 2 years' time, or in a book that in about 2 years' time needs to be finished. So actually, I have to hurry. But these images may help a bit to sort of organize our thoughts about the possibilities in this direction. One example I've already mentioned of images in this collection which were simply not known to have been sent to Gesner before. And now we know this simply because the annotation tells us whether Plato was right or not right. That is, of course, something that has to be checked in so far that this is possible. So we can add simply to the number of images that were made available via correspondence to Gesner, and thereby simply have a larger stock, let's say, to reason with. These are, in fact, I should go forward. Those fish were, in fact, images that were sent to Gesner by Horstius, and again, that were not printed, so Horstius from Rome. So if we're talking about establishing rules about how to depict, what to depict, what can we think about? The one is, in a way, a simple question, and it has to do with what kind of animals, which animals do you print, or do you want included in a book on natural history, a survey, an encyclopedia on natural history in that period? So it's a selection of what, and has that changed over time? Obviously it has, since the 16th century, but I find it not so easy to reason in a situation of the 16th century in which actually Gesner's Historia Animalium was one of the very first encyclopedias about animals to appear. Obviously, apart from the famous works of Belon and Rondelet in France, and slightly earlier books like Turner's on birds and so on, but not all of those were equally profusely illustrated. So Gesner's work was, and it has a massive amount of visual information in it. So the question of which animals to represent in the 16th century, in a situation in which actually there isn't really yet a tradition of doing this, or how to put together a book, it raises a lot of questions for me. And there are certain animals in this collection of which I think, well, they certainly were there then, and they continued being in such books for a long time, partly because the Gesner's work was so influential. But they are not necessarily there now anymore. So maybe this tells you something about the changing canon in the period after Gesner's work. Obviously, the cat, which is one of my favorites. I don't think we see many cats like this anymore at this moment, not even in the 19th century. Yeah, I mean, the cat maybe, yes, but not in works of natural history. You don't have normal, you know, ordinary cats that you see all over around you. But maybe at that moment, a cat was either regarded as relevant to an encyclopedia of natural history, or it was regarded as relevant to Gessner because he simply wanted to include everything, everything that could be known about all animals that was available to him. So I don't really know. I don't have the answer to this. And here is another pretty famous image from Gessner with the original and the printed version. This is, even according to the printed text in Gessner's work and according to the caption, it was a drawing made after a dead shark. So it was obviously not ideal. It wasn't even ideal according to Gessner. He probably would have preferred a better drawing and something more lively looking. But this was the best he could do, so he did include it. And it probably reflects the fact that Gessner was in Switzerland, not exactly close to where sharks can be found, and that he simply, this was what he had and what he wanted to work with, had to work with. This is not how you find sharks usually in later books, unless they are directly inspired by Gessner again. Then we have a group, and then I want to step into the domain of how to represent rather than which animals to choose. The how to represent is again something about establishing a kind of canon of what you could call scientific illustration, except illustration is almost by definition something in which you have images accompanying a text and illustrating something else, whereas if you talk about drawings, as you find in the Amsterdam albums, we are not certain that those drawings were necessarily always made in order to be printed. And often I think they actually were not. They were used as such, but they were not necessarily made by people who had a printed encyclopedia of animals in their minds as artists. All the more so because most of those animals were actually sent from all over Europe by correspondence to Glusius. And those correspondents probably just sort of rummaged around in their drawers and said, oh my God, here I have a drawing, can send it to Gessner. So this is again something we have to think about, the origin of these images, before being able to conclude that they were actually meant to set standards of scientific illustration, although maybe eventually they did so unintentionally. So here we have the profile images of various animals. I'm not totally sure whether this has set a tradition of depicting animals in a way as they are depicted here. That, again, is more of a question of mine than something I can answer, but I wonder about it. Here we have fish also depicted in a fairly standardized way. You can even find that in fairly modern works on fish, in which you have this kind of, you know, putting them horizontally and seen from the side, the flat fish, seen in a flat way, let's say, from above. Here you have the gladius, the swordfish, a really clumsy looking one, I should say. But again, this is a case in which Gessner was actually not very content with the image. And he says in the printed text that he is making a kind of composite image in which he glues, almost literally, perhaps, I don't know about that, he glues the part of the fish that he was sent by, again, John Caius from England, to the body and tail which come from Rondelet, so from a printed illustration. And that's what you can find in the text. So now we can here sort of put the illustration, if you really put them next to each other, you can see the image that was sent to him by John Caius, and you can see almost with this kind of game that you do, like tell the differences, like where are the fins, actually they're different, the head looks, yes, the tail is really, so it is really a composite image in this case, you can see it happening. You can also see Gessner actually correcting himself, or rather correcting Caius, because he wasn't content with that image, he sort of fits something together. So there, in that case, you are able to tell that Gessner is really trying to make it better, let's say. There's another example of that kind of process. It's not really successive corrections, but let's say successive presenting successive images in order to make more information available by Gessner. Here you see the images of the lynx in the first 1551 edition of the Historia Animalium Part 1. One, the more clumsy looking one up there is copied after Olaus Magnus. And the source of this image we don't know. But obviously Gessner thought it was worthwhile to put both in that edition. If you go to the 1560 edition of the Icones, so the coffee table version basically of Gessner, you see the links that we have here in the Amsterdam albums, that one, it's printed in there, and together with the funny South American animal Sue. And in the 1563 edition, you see all three of them together. So there is really a, some author has said that this was obviously not by chance, but because Gessner wanted to give the readers the opportunity to have at least a kind of comparative visual information so they could make up their own minds about this. It is also clear that between the 1551 and the 63 editions, Gessner is continuing to collect information and images and thinking about what would be the better image to maybe replace an earlier image with a better one, or if they were not better, at least to have more images together. And then to go to my almost final case, the further development that you see in, let's say, the history of scientific illustration, if you want to call it that, is a move away from the individual portrait of the plant or the animal. Only that this has been discussed in far more detail for plants than for animals. In fact, I don't know of any real discussion for this whole theme in with respect to animals, but maybe there is one. Anyhow, the idea is basically that in the mid-16th century, so exactly the period we're talking about, you see a move, the beginning of a move away from the depicting of plants, of naturalia, as they were exactly at that moment. Moving, so that is more or less that version, in which you see every damaged leaf, every worm-eaten root, and so on. And you certainly don't see a plant with both fruit and flowers at the same time, unless that, you know, obviously that happens occasionally, but not usually it doesn't. So basically, you move away from that individual portrait of a plant or natural being in the direction of a kind of generic image of a plant. Now, much as we think we know about that move, except the chronology is not that clear, the successive steps in this process aren't very clear, and lots of other things are actually not that clear to me, but it seems to have happened. There's not much discussion about whether this happened or how this happened with respect to animals. And I want to show you one example. Again, it's quite a well-known image from Gessner, in which you see the printed version here, the blowfish. And you see that the move in, and I'll make it more clear to you perhaps, the difference here between the image that's the drawing and the image that is the printed version means actually de-individualizing it, because that is a portrait of a fish that has been hanging from a little hook, and that also explains why it has such a weird bump on its back. It's simply because its skin was being pulled up, because it was hanging. And it's understandable, of course, that somebody who is making a printed illustration would want to, you know, remove, let's say, do a kind of a Photoshop with, you know, taking out the hook and making it more into a generic image of an animal. Now, this is obviously my interpretation of what was happening here. So, just to conclude, it is, I think, really abundantly clear that Gessner's works on the Historia Animalium, in particular, of course, that he would not have been able to make these particular kind of encyclopedias without a correspondence network. And I'm not just talking about the textual information, the knowledge that went into it, but about the visual information that they simply couldn't have been made without that. And maybe we have some indications in this material that actually Gessner was kind of mail ordering images from other places in Europe. I think, especially thinking back to what happened in the Clusius network, that perhaps The kind of images that Gessner himself commissioned, or those that were simply sent to him from all over Europe by means of correspondence, that they also may have had the role of, unintentionally perhaps, the role of determining the standards or beginning to set the standards of how to represent living naturalia. So this is, as you can see and hear, this is very much an idea that is in the beginning stages of actually being maybe proved. How to prove it, I'm not sure yet, but that's what I'm going to work on in the next year at least, maybe the next few years, or possibly the rest of my life, I don't know. But that was it for today. Thank you.